Before answering, he seized my right hand and felt the palm. "You're strong, eh?" he said. "Very strong," I said, untruly. "Yeah? Let me see you lift that crate." It was a huge wicker basket full of potatoes. I took hold of it and found that, so far from lifting it, I couldn't even move it. The man in the bowler hat watched me, then shrugged his shoulders and turned away. I made off. When I had gone some distance, I looked back and saw four men lifting the basket onto a cart. It weighed 300 weight, possibly. The man had seen that I was no use and taken this way of getting rid of me. Sometimes in his hopeful moments, Boris spent 50 centimes on a stamp and wrote to one of his ex-mistresses asking for money. Only one of them ever replied. It was a woman who, besides having been his mistress, owed him 200 francs. When Boris saw the letter waiting and recognised the handwriting, he was wild with hope. We seized the letter and rushed up to Boris's room to read it, like a child with stolen sweets. Boris read the letter, then handed it silently to me. It ran, "My little cherished wolf, with what delight did I open thy charming letter, reminding me of the days of our perfect love, and of the so dear kisses which I have received from thy lips. Such memories linger for ever in the heart, like the perfume of a flower that is dead. As to thy request for 200 francs, alas, it is impossible. Thou dost not know, my dear one, how I am desolated to hear of thy embarrassments. But what wouldst thou? In this life, which is so sad, trouble comes to everyone. I, too, have had my share. My little sister has been ill. Ah, the poor little one, how she suffered. And we are obliged to pay I know not what to the doctor. All our money is gone, and we are passing, I assure thee, very difficult days. Courage, my little wolf, always the courage. Remember that the bad days are not forever, and the trouble which seems so terrible will disappear at last. Rest assured, my dear one, that I will remember thee always, and receive the most sincere embraces of her who has never ceased to love thee, thy Yvonne. This letter disappointed Boris so much that he went straight to bed and wouldn't look for work again that day. My 60 francs lasted about a fortnight. I'd given up the pretense of going out to restaurants, and we used to eat in my room, one of us sitting on the bed and the other on the chair. Boris would contribute his 2 francs, and I 3 or 4 francs, and we would buy bread, potatoes, milk and cheese, and make soup over my spirit lamp. We had a saucepan and a coffee bowl and 1 spoon. Every day there was a polite squabble as to who should eat out of the saucepan and who out of the coffee bowl. The saucepan held more. And every day, to my secret anger, Boris gave in first and had the saucepan. Sometimes we had more bread in the evening, sometimes not. Our linen was getting filthy, and it was 3 weeks since I had had a bath. Boris, so he said, had not had a bath for months. It was tobacco that made everything tolerable. We had plenty of tobacco, for some time before Boris had met a soldier, the soldiers are given their tobacco free, and bought 20 or 30 packets at 50 centimes each. All this was far worse for Boris than for me. The walking and sleeping on the floor kept his leg and back in constant pain, and with his vast Russian appetite he suffered torments of hunger, though he never seemed to grow thinner. On the whole, he was surprisingly gay, and he had vast capacities for hope. He used to say, seriously, that he had a patron saint who watched over him, and when things were very bad, he would search the gutter for money, saying that the saint often dropped a 2-franc piece there. One day we were waiting in the Rue Royale. There was a Russian restaurant nearby, and we were going to ask for a job there. Suddenly, Boris made up his mind to go into the Madeleine and burn a 50-centime candle to his patron saint. Then, coming out, he said that he would be on the safe side and solemnly put a match to a 50-centime stamp as a sacrifice to the immortal gods. Perhaps the gods and the saints didn't get on together. At any rate, we missed the job. On some mornings, Boris collapsed in the most utter despair. He would lie in bed, almost weeping, cursing the Jew with whom he lived. Of late, the Jew had become restive about paying the daily 2 francs, and, what was worse, had begun putting on intolerable airs of patronage. Boris said that I, as an Englishman, could not conceive what torture it was to a Russian family to be at the mercy of a Jew, A Jew, mon ami, a veritable Jew. And he hasn't even the decency to be ashamed of it. To think that I, a captain in the Russian army... Have I ever told you, mon ami, that I was a captain in the 2nd Siberian Rifles? Yes, a captain, and my father was a colonel. And here I am, eating the bread of a Jew. A Jew! I will tell you what Jews are like. Once in the early months of the war, we were on the march, and we had halted at a village for the night. A horrible old Jew, with a red beard like Judas Iscariot, came sneaking up to my billet. I asked him what he wanted. "Your Honor," he said, "I have brought a girl for you, a beautiful young girl, only 17. It will only be 50 francs." "Thank you," I said. "You can take her away again. I don't want to catch any diseases." "Diseases?" cried the Jew. "Mais, monsieur le capitaine, there's no fear of that. It's my own daughter." That is the Jewish national character for you. Have I ever told you, mon ami, that in the old Russian army it was considered bad form to spit on a Jew? Yes, we thought a Russian officer's spittle was too precious to be wasted on Jews. Etc., etc. On these days, Boris usually declared himself too ill to go out and look for work. He would lie till evening in the greyish, verminous sheets, smoking and reading old newspapers. Sometimes we played chess. We had no board, but we wrote down the moves on a piece of paper, and afterwards we made a board from the side of a packing case and a set of men from buttons, Belgian coins and the like. Boris, like many Russians, had a passion for chess. It was a saying of his that the rules of chess are the same as the rules of love and war, and that if you can win at one, you can win at the others. But he also said that if you have a chessboard, you do not mind being hungry, which was certainly not true in my case.
This ends Disc 1. Down and Out in Paris and London. Disc 2.
Chapter 7. My money oozed away. To 8 francs, to 4 francs, to 1 franc, to 25 centimes. And 25 centimes is useless, for it will buy nothing except a newspaper. We went several days on dry bread, and then I was 2.5 days with nothing to eat whatever. This was an ugly experience. There are people who do fasting cures of 3 weeks or more, and they say that fasting is quite pleasant after the 4th day. I don't know, never having gone beyond the 3rd day. Probably it seems different when one is doing it voluntarily and is not underfed at the start. The 1st day, too inert to look for work, I borrowed a rod and went fishing in the Seine, baiting with bluebottles. I hoped to catch enough for a meal, but of course I did not. The Seine is full of dace, but they grew cunning during the siege of Paris, and none of them has been caught since, except in nets. On the 2nd day I thought of pawning my overcoat, but it seemed too far to walk to the pawn shop, and I spent the day in bed, reading the memoirs of Sherlock Holmes. It was all that I felt equal to without food. Hunger reduces one to an utterly spineless, brainless condition, more like the after-effects of influenza than anything else. It is as though one had been turned into a jellyfish, or as though all one's blood had been pumped out and lukewarm water substituted. Complete inertia is my chief memory of hunger. That, and being obliged to spit very frequently, and the spittle being curiously white and flocculent, like cuckoo spit. I don't know the reason for this, but everyone who's gone hungry several days has noticed it. On the 3rd morning, I felt very much better. I realized that I must do something at once, and I decided to go and ask Boris to let me share his 2 francs, at any rate for a day or two. When I arrived, I found Boris in bed and furiously angry. As soon as I came in, he burst out, almost choking, "He has taken it back, the dirty thief! He has taken it back!" "Who's taken what?" I said. "The Jew! Taken my 2 francs, the dog, the thief! He robbed me in my sleep!" It appeared that on the previous night the Jew had flatly refused to pay the daily 2 francs. They had argued and argued, and at last the Jew had consented to hand over the money. He had done it, Boris said, in the most offensive manner, making a little speech about how kind he was, and extorting abject gratitude, and then, in the morning, he had stolen the money back before Boris was awake. This was a blow. I was horribly disappointed, for I had allowed my belly to expect food. A great mistake when one is hungry. However, rather to my surprise, Boris was far from despairing. He sat up in bed, lighted his pipe, and reviewed the situation. "Now listen, mon ami, this is a tight corner. We have only 25 centimes between us, and I don't suppose the Jew will ever pay my 2 francs again. In any case, his behaviour is becoming intolerable. Will you believe it? The other night he had the indecency to bring a woman in here while I was there on the floor? The low animal! And I have a worse thing to tell you. The Jew intends clearing out of here. He owes a week's rent, and his idea is to avoid paying that and give me the slip at the same time. If the Jew shoots the moon, I shall be left without a roof, and the patron will take my suitcase in lieu of rent, curse him. We have got to make a vigorous move."
"All right, but what can we do? It seems to me that the only thing is to pawn our overcoats and get some food."
"We'll do that, of course. But I must get my possessions out of this house first. To think of my photographs being seized. Well, my plan is ready. I'm going to forestall the Jew and shoot the moon myself. Fiche le camp. Retreat, you understand? I think that is the correct move, eh?"
"But, my dear Boris, how can you in daytime? You're bound to be caught."
"Ah, well, it will need strategy, of course. Our patron is on the watch for people slipping out without paying their rent. He's been had that way before. He and his wife take it in turns all day to sit in the office. What misers, these Frenchmen! But I have thought of a way to do it, if you will help."
I didn't feel in a very helpful mood, but I asked Boris what his plan was. He explained it carefully.
"Now listen. We must start by pawning our overcoats. First go back to your room and fetch your overcoat, then come back here and fetch mine, and smuggle it out under cover of yours. Take them to the pawn shop in the Rue des Francs Bourgeois. You ought to get 20 francs for the two, with luck. Then go down to the Seine bank and fill your pockets with stones, and bring them back and put them in my suitcase. You see the idea? I shall wrap up as many of my things as I can carry in a newspaper and go down and ask the patron the way to the nearest laundry. I shall be very brazen and casual, you understand? And of course the patron will think the bundle is nothing but dirty linen. Or if he does suspect anything, he will do what he always does, the mean sneak. He will go up to my room and feel the weight of my suitcase. And when he feels the weight of stones, he will think it is still full. Strategy, eh? Then afterwards I can come back and carry my other things out in my pockets."
"But what about the suitcase?"
"All that we shall have to abandon it. The miserable thing only cost about 20 francs. Besides, one always abandons something in a retreat. Look at Napoleon at the Beretsina. He abandoned his whole army."
Boris was so pleased with this scheme, he called it une ruse de guerre, that he almost forgot being hungry. Its main weakness, that he would have nowhere to sleep after shooting the moon, he ignored. At first, the ruse de guerre worked well. I went home and fetched my overcoat, that made already 9 kilometres on an empty belly, and smuggled Boris's coat out successfully. Then a hitch occurred. The receiver at the pawn shop, a nasty, sour-faced, interfering little man, a typical French official, refused the coats on the ground that they were not wrapped up in anything. He said that they must be put either in a valise or a cardboard box. This spoiled everything, for we had no box of any kind, and with only 25 centimes between us, we couldn't buy one. I went back and told Boris the bad news.
"Merde," he said, "that makes it awkward. Well, no matter, there is always a way. We'll put the overcoats in my suitcase."
"But how are we to get the suitcase past the patron? He's sitting almost in the door of the office. It's impossible."
"How easily you despair, mon ami. Where is that English obstinacy that I have read of? Courage, we'll manage it."
Boris thought for a little while, and then produced another cunning plan. The essential difficulty was to hold the patron's attention for perhaps 5 seconds, while we could slip past with the suitcase. But, as it happened, the patron had just one weak spot: that he was interested in le sport, and was ready to talk if you approached him on this subject. Boris read an article about bicycle races in an old copy of the Petit Parisien, and then, when he had reconnoitred the stairs, went down and managed to set the patron talking. Meanwhile,
I waited at the foot of the stairs, with the overcoats under one arm and the suitcase under the other. Boris was to give a cough when he thought the moment favourable. I waited, trembling, for at any moment the patron's wife might come out of the door opposite the office, and then the game was up. However, presently, Boris coughed. I sneaked rapidly past the office and out into the street, rejoicing that my shoes didn't creak. The plan might have failed if Boris had been thinner, for his big shoulders blocked the doorway of the office. His nerve was splendid, too. He went on laughing and talking in the most casual way, and so loud that he quite covered any noise I made. When I was well away, he came and joined me round the corner, and we bolted. And then, after all our trouble, the receiver at the pawn shop again refused the overcoats. He told me, one could see his French soul revelling in the pedantry of it, that I had not sufficient papers of identification. My carte d'identité was not enough, and I must show a passport or addressed envelopes. Boris had addressed envelopes by the score, but his carte d'identité was out of order. He never renewed it so as to avoid the tax. So we couldn't pawn the overcoats in his name. All we could do was trudge up to my room, get the necessary papers, and take the coats to the pawn shop in the Boulevard Port Royal. I left Boris at my room and went down to the pawn shop. When I got there, I found that it was shut and would not open till 4 in the afternoon. It was now about 1:30, and I had walked 12 kilometres and had no food for 60 hours. Fate seemed to be playing a series of extraordinarily unamusing jokes. Then the luck changed as though by a miracle. I was walking home through the Rue Broca, when suddenly, glittering on the cobbles, I saw a 5-sou piece. I pounced on it, hurried home, got our other 5-sou piece, and bought a pound of potatoes. There was only enough alcohol in the stove to parboil them, and we had no salt, but we wolfed them, skins and all. After that, we felt like new men and sat playing chess till the pawn shop opened. At 4 o'clock, I went back to the pawn shop. I wasn't hopeful, for if I had only got 70 francs before, what could I expect for 2 shabby overcoats and a cardboard suitcase? Boris had said 20 francs, but I thought it would be 10 francs, or even 5. Worse yet, I might be refused altogether, like poor numero 83 on the previous occasion. I sat on the front bench, so as not to see people laughing when the clerk said 5 francs. At last, the clerk called my number. Numero 117. Yes, I said, standing up. 50 francs? It was almost as great a shock as the 70 francs had been the time before. I believe now that the clerk had mixed my number up with someone else's, for one couldn't have sold the coats outright for 50 francs. I had hurried home and walked into my room with my hands behind my back, saying nothing. Boris was playing with the chessboard. He looked up eagerly. What did you get? He exclaimed. What? Not 20 francs? Surely you got 10 francs anyway. Nom de Dieu, 5 francs? That is a bit too thick. Mon ami, don't say it was 5 francs. If you say it was 5 francs, I shall really begin to think of suicide. I threw the 50-franc note onto the table. Boris turned white as chalk, and then, springing up, seized my hand and gave it a grip that almost broke the bones. We ran out, bought bread and wine, a piece of meat, and alcohol for the stove, and gorged. After eating, Boris became more optimistic than I had ever known him. What did I tell you? He said. The fortune of war. This morning with 5 sous, and now look at us. I have always said it. There is nothing easier to get than money. And that reminds me. I have a friend in the Rue Fondary, whom we might go and see. He has cheated me of 4,000 francs, the thief. He is the greatest thief alive when he is sober. But it is a curious thing. He is quite honest when he's drunk. I should think he would be drunk by 6 in the evening. Let's go and find him. Very likely he will pay up 100 on account. Merde! He might pay 200. Allons-y! We went to the Rue Fondary and found the man, and he was drunk. But we did not get our 100 francs. As soon as he and Boris met, there was a terrible altercation on the pavement. The other man declared that he did not owe Boris a penny, but that, on the contrary, Boris owed him 4,000 francs, and both of them kept appealing to me for my opinion. I never understood the rights of the matter. The two argued and argued, first in the street, then in a bistro, then in a prefix restaurant where we went for dinner, then in another bistro. Finally, having called one another thieves for 2 hours, they went off together on a drinking bout that finished up the last sou of Boris's money. Boris slept the night at the house of a cobbler, another Russian refugee in the Commerce quarter. Meanwhile, I had 8 francs left and plenty of cigarettes, and was stuffed to the eyes with food and drink. It was a marvellous change for the better after 2 bad days. Chapter 8. We had now 28 francs in hand, and could start looking for work once more. Boris was still sleeping on some mysterious terms at the house of the cobbler, and he'd managed to borrow another 20 francs from a Russian friend. He had friends, mostly ex-officers like himself, here and there all over Paris. Some were waiters or dishwashers, some drove taxis, a few lived on women, some had managed to bring money away from Russia and own garages or dancing halls. In general, the Russian refugees in Paris are hard-working people and have put up with their bad luck far better than one can imagine Englishmen of the same class doing. There are exceptions, of course. Boris told me of an exiled Russian duke whom he had once met, who frequented expensive restaurants. The duke would find out if there was a Russian officer among the waiters, and after he had dined, call him in a friendly way to his table. "Ah," the duke would say, "so you are an old soldier like myself. These are bad days, huh? Well, well, the Russian soldier fears nothing. And what was your regiment?" "The so-and-so, sir," the waiter would answer. "A very gallant regiment. I inspected them in 1912. By the way, I have unfortunately left my note-case at home. A Russian officer will, I know, oblige me with 300 francs. If the waiter had 300 francs, he would hand it over. I'd, of course, never see it again. The Duke made quite a lot in this way. Probably the waiters didn't mind being swindled. A duke is a duke, even in exile. It was through one of these Russian refugees that Boris heard of something which seemed to promise money. 2 days after we had pawned the overcoats, Boris said to me rather mysteriously, 'Tell me, mon ami, have you any political opinions?' 'No,' I said, 'neither have I. Of course, one is always a patriot, but still, did not Moses say something about spoiling the Egyptians? As an Englishman, you will have read the Bible. What I mean is, would you object to earning money from communists?' 'No, of course not.' 'Well, it appears that there is a Russian secret society in Paris who might do something for us. They are communists. In fact, they are agents for the Bolsheviks. They act as a friendly society, get in touch with exiled Russians, and try to get them to turn Bolshevik. My friend has joined their society, and he thinks they would help us if we went to them.' 'But what can they do for us? In any case, they won't help me. I'm not a Russian.' 'That is just the point. It seems that they are correspondents for a Moscow paper, and they want some articles on English politics. If we go to them at once, they may commission you to write the articles.' 'Me? But I don't know anything about politics.' 'Merde, neither do they. Who does know anything about politics? It's easy. All you have to do is copy it out of the English papers. Isn't there a Paris Daily Mail? Copy it from that.' 'But the Daily Mail is a conservative paper. They loathe the communists.' 'Well, say the opposite of what the Daily Mail says. Then you can't be wrong. We mustn't throw this chance away, mon ami. It might mean hundreds of francs.' I didn't like the idea, for the Paris police are very hard on communists, especially if they're foreigners, and I was already under suspicion. Some months before, a detective had seen me come out of the office of a communist weekly paper, and I had had a great deal of trouble with the police. If they caught me going to this secret society, it might mean deportation. However, the chance seemed too good to be missed. That afternoon, Boris's friend, another waiter, came to take us to the rendezvous. I cannot remember the name of the street. It was a shabby street running south from the Seine Bank, somewhere near the Chamber of Deputies. Boris's friend insisted on great caution. We loitered casually down the street, marked the doorway we were to enter. It was a laundry. And then strolled back again, keeping an eye on all the windows and cafes. If the place were known as a haunt of communists, it was probably watched, and we intended to go home if we saw anyone at all like a detective.
I was frightened, but Boris enjoyed these conspiratorial proceedings and quite forgot that he was about to trade with the slayers of his parents. When we were certain that the coast was clear, we dived quickly into the doorway. In the laundry was a French woman ironing clothes, who told us that the Russian gentleman lived up a staircase across the courtyard. We went up several flights of dark stairs and emerged onto a landing. A strong, surly-looking young man, with hair growing low on his head, was standing at the top of the stairs. As I came up, he looked at me suspiciously, barred the way with his arm, and said something in Russian. "Mot d'ordre," he said sharply when I did not answer. I stopped, startled. I hadn't expected passwords. "Mot d'ordre," repeated the Russian. Boris's friend, who was walking behind, now came forward and said something in Russian, either the password or an explanation. At this, the surly young man seemed satisfied and led us into a small, shabby room with frosted windows. It was like a very poverty-stricken office, with propaganda posters in Russian lettering and a huge, crude picture of Lenin tacked on the walls. At the table sat an unshaven Russian in shirt sleeves, addressing newspaper wrappers from a pile in front of him. As I came in, he spoke to me in French with a bad accent. "This is very careless," he exclaimed fussily. "Why have you come here without a parcel of washing?" "Washing? Everybody who comes here brings washing. It looks as though they were going to the laundry downstairs. Bring a good large bundle next time. We don't want the police on our tracks." This was even more conspiratorial than I had expected. Boris sat down in the only vacant chair, and there was a great deal of talking in Russian. Only the unshaven man talked. The surly one leaned against the wall with his eyes on me, as though he still suspected me. It was queer standing in the little secret room with its revolutionary posters, listening to a conversation which I didn't understand a word of. The Russians talked quickly and eagerly, with smiles and shrugs of the shoulders. I wondered what it was all about. They would be calling each other Little Father, I thought, and Little Dove, and Ivan Alexandrovich, like the characters in Russian novels, and the talk would be of revolutions. The unshaven man would be saying firmly, "We never argue. Controversy is a bourgeois pastime. Deeds are our arguments." Then I gathered that it was not this exactly. 20 francs was being demanded for an entrance fee, apparently, and Boris was promising to pay it. We had just 17 francs in the world. Finally, Boris produced our precious store of money and paid 5 francs on account. At this, the surly man looked less suspicious and sat down on the edge of the table. The unshaven one began to question me in French, making notes on a slip of paper. "Was I a communist?" he asked. "By sympathy," I answered. I had never joined any organization. "Did I understand the political situation in England?" "Oh, of course, of course." I mentioned the names of various ministers and made some contemptuous remarks about the Labour Party. "And what about Le Sport? Could I do articles on Le Sport? Football and socialism have some mysterious connection on the continent." "Oh, of course, again." Both men nodded gravely. The unshaven one said, "Evidemment, you have a thorough knowledge of conditions in England. Could you undertake to write a series of articles for a Moscow weekly paper? We will give you the particulars." "Certainly." "Then, comrade, you will hear from us by the first post tomorrow. Or possibly the second post. Our rate of pay is 150 francs an article. Remember to bring a parcel of washing next time you come. Au revoir, comrade." We went downstairs, looked carefully out of the laundry to see if there was anyone in the street, and slipped out. Boris was wild with joy. In a sort of sacrificial ecstasy, he rushed into the nearest tobacconist's and spent 50 centimes on a cigar. He came out thumping his stick on the pavement and beaming. "At last, at last! Now, mon ami, our fortune really is made. You took them in finely. Did you hear him call you comrade? 150 francs an article! Mon de Dieu, what luck!" Next morning, when I heard the postman, I rushed down to the bistro for my letter. To my disappointment, it hadn't come. I stayed at home for the second post. Still no letter. When 3 days had gone by, and I hadn't heard from the secret society, We gave up hope, deciding that they must have found somebody else to do their articles. 10 days later, we made another visit to the office of the Secret Society, taking care to bring a parcel that looked like washing. And the Secret Society had vanished. The woman in the laundry knew nothing. She simply said that ces messieurs had left some days ago after trouble about the rent. What fools we looked standing there with our parcel. But it was a consolation that we'd paid only 5 francs instead of 20. And that was the last we ever heard of the Secret Society. Who or what they really were, nobody knew. Personally, I don't think they had anything to do with the Communist Party. I think they were simply swindlers who preyed upon Russian refugees by extracting entrance fees to an imaginary society. It was quite safe, and no doubt they're still doing it in some other city. They were clever fellows, played their part admirably. Their office looked exactly as a secret communist office should look. And as for that touch about bringing a parcel of washing, it was genius. Chapter 9. For 3 more days we continued traipsing about looking for work, coming home for diminishing meals of soup and bread in my bedroom. There were now 2 gleams of hope. In the first place, Boris had heard of a possible job at the Hotel X, near the Place de la Concorde. And, in the second, the patron of the new restaurant in the Rue du Commerce had at last come back. We went down in the afternoon and saw him. On the way, Boris talked of the vast fortunes we should make if we got this job, and on the importance of making a good impression on the patron. Appearance. Appearance is everything, mon ami. Give me a new suit, and I will borrow 1,000 francs by dinner time. What a pity I did not buy a collar when we had money. I turned my collar inside out this morning, but what is the use? One side is as dirty as the other. Do you think I look hungry, mon ami? You look pale. Curse it! What can one do on bread and potatoes? It is fatal to look hungry. It makes people want to kick you. Wait! He stopped at a jeweller's window and smacked his cheeks sharply to bring the blood into them. Then, before the flush had faded, we hurried into the restaurant and introduced ourselves to the patron. The patron was a short, fattish, very dignified man with wavy grey hair, dressed in a smart, double-breasted flannel suit, and smelling of scent. Boris told me that he too was an ex-colonel of the Russian army. His wife was there too, a horrid, fat French woman with a dead white face and scarlet lips, reminding me of cold veal and tomatoes. The patron greeted Boris genially, and they talked together in Russian for a few minutes. I stood in the background, preparing to tell some lies about my experience as a dishwasher. Then the patron came over towards me. I shuffled uneasily, trying to look servile. Boris had rubbed it into me that a plongeur is a slave's slave, and I expected the patron to treat me like dirt. To my astonishment, he seized me warmly by the hand. "So, you are an Englishman," he exclaimed. "But how charming! I need not ask, then, whether you are a golfer." "Mais certainement," I said, seeing that this was expected of me. "All my life I have wanted to play golf. Will you, my dear monsieur, be so kind as to show me a few of the principal strokes?" Apparently this was the Russian way of doing business. The patron listened attentively while I explained the difference between a driver and an iron, and then suddenly informed me that it was all entendu. Boris was to be maître d'hôtel when the restaurant opened, and I, plongeur, with a chance of rising to lavatory attendant if trade was good. "When would the restaurant open?" I asked. "Exactly a fortnight from today," the patron answered grandly. He had a manner of waving his hand and flicking off his cigarette ash at the same time, which looked very grand. "Exactly a fortnight from today, in time for lunch." Then, with obvious pride, he showed us over the restaurant. It was a smallish place, consisting of a bar, a dining room, and a kitchen no bigger than the average bathroom. The patron was decorating it in a trumpery, picturesque style. He called it Le Normand. It was a matter of sham beams stuck on the plaster and the like, and proposed to call it the Auberge de Jean Cottard, to give it a medieval effect. He had a leaflet printed, full of lies about the historical associations of the quarter, and this leaflet actually claimed, among other things, that there had once been an inn on the site of the restaurant which was frequented by Charlemagne. The patron was very pleased with this touch. He was also having the bar decorated with indecent pictures by an artist from the salon. Finally, he gave us each an expensive cigarette, and after some more talk he went home. I felt strongly that we should never get any good from this restaurant. The patron had looked to me like a cheat, and what was worse, an incompetent cheat, and I had seen two unmistakable duns hanging about the back door. But Boris, seeing himself a maître d'hôtel once more, would not be discouraged. "We've brought it off. Only a fortnight to hold out. What is a fortnight? Food? Je m'en fiche. To think that in only 3 weeks I shall have my mistress. Will she be dark or fair, I wonder? I don't mind, so long as she is not too thin."
2 bad days followed. We had only 60 centimes left, and we spent it on 1/2 pound of bread, with a piece of garlic to rub it with. The point of rubbing garlic on bread is that the taste lingers and gives one the illusion of having fed recently. We sat most of that day in the Jardin des Plantes. Boris had shots with stones at the tame pigeons, but always missed them, and after that we wrote dinner menus on the backs of envelopes.